From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. The presidential race, it's down to the wire in New Hampshire.
Hillary Clinton is being protected by a totally rigged system. And now it's up to the American people to deliver justice at the ballot box tomorrow. That's what's going to happen.
Also today, two parents on ballot question two. One who wants all her children in charter schools.
As a mom, you have a sense of ease to know that your child is getting what they need. You have a sense of comfort. You don't have to wake up like, oh my goodness, she's missing it. She's missing that opportunity.
The other who's staying with her district school.
I want to keep them in public school because we have to make public school accountable. If something's not working, we don't just throw it away and ditch that idea and go somewhere else. No, we make it work here.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, we've made it to the last day of the presidential campaign. Both candidates are blitzing through multiple swing states today in one final push before tomorrow's election. Donald Trump is scheduled to be in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and New Hampshire. He began the day in Sarasota, Florida.
Hillary Clinton is being protected by a totally rigged system. And now it's up to the American people to deliver justice at the ballot box tomorrow. That's what's going to happen.
Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton will be in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina today. And in New Hampshire, her top surrogate, President Barack Obama, will be stumping for the Democratic nominee. Here he is this morning in Michigan.
You have the chance to reject a coarse, divisive, mean-spirited politics that would take us backwards. You can elect a leader who spent her entire life trying to appeal to the better natures, angels of our nature. You have a chance to elect our first female president.
WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is at the Obama rally at UNH in Durham, and he joins us now. Anthony, good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, Meghna.
All right. Well, we can hear the activity behind you. The president will be speaking shortly. Why him in New Hampshire today?
Well, he's in Durham, New Hampshire, because the Clinton campaign very much wants to get young people out to the polls. Latest polls show that while they're doing very well among registered Democrats, they're even pulling in some Republicans. And according to at least one poll, which came out just recently from the UNH, Clinton is ahead in New Hampshire. Among younger voters, not nearly as much. In fact, she's splitting younger voters with Donald Trump. So this is an effort the day before the election to really piece together that one piece of the Obama coalition, namely younger voters. And so they're here at the UNH trying to do that.
What's the mood in the arena where you are?
Well, it's pretty exciting. They got the marching band, which you just heard take a break in the background. Lots of students were lined up way down the road before I came in here. And considering we're in the middle of a day of classes, I'd say there's a good deal of excitement. And a lot of people are very aware that the President of the United States is about to enter shortly.
You know, Anthony, it feels like every time we've talked to you in the past couple of weeks, at least if not more, and you've been in New Hampshire, you've been on a college campus. Why is the Clinton campaign, it seems like almost exclusively, campaigning in those places?
Yeah, well, I mean, I really think it comes down to this effort to capture these younger voters. You know, we put out a poll, Meghna, as you know, that showed this race in New Hampshire tied up. The University of New Hampshire Polling Center released a poll just yesterday, which shows Hillary Clinton with an 11-point lead. And what explains that lead is Donald Trump is polling only about 80% of Republicans, whereas Clinton is getting about 96% of Democrats. And in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans, that gives her a big advantage. But among younger people, they're splitting voters under the age of 34 or 35. So that's why you're seeing all this effort in recent days, whether it's at Dartmouth or Keene State College or University of New Hampshire or the University of Southern New Hampshire. That's where all the events have been taking place, because the Clinton campaign believes that if they can get these young people out to the polls, they can win tomorrow.
Well, and in fact, we have some tape here of President Obama, who was also in Michigan a little earlier today, pretty much acknowledging the importance of the youth vote.
Now, think about where we were 8 years ago. The thing is, I just realized some of you were like 10. Some of you were, let's admit it, while I was out there campaigning, you were watching the Disney Channel.
Maybe some of them still are.
Obama and some of them probably still are. But we're probably going to hear a lot of that sort of thing today, urging folks to get out to the polls and vote.
Okay, so there were so many developments over the weekend here in the presidential race. Hillary Clinton herself was in New Hampshire just yesterday. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was really something. I mean, you know, my weekend started with a Donald Trump rally in Atkinson on Friday and ended up last night in Manchester with Hillary Clinton and James Taylor and, of course, Khazir Khan, the father of the Muslim American soldier who was killed in Iraq, who made such a splash at the Democratic National Convention. And, Megna, I got to tell you, it's like following two parallel universes. Huh. I mean, on Friday, you've got Donald Trump talking about those new jobs numbers and things just couldn't be worse. You go to the Democrats, it's like, no, we're going in the right direction. You know, Donald Trump is talking about building the wall and ending the Syrian refugee program and once and for all dealing with Islamic terrorism. You know, at the Hillary Clinton rally, Khazir Khan is challenging Donald Trump, asking him if there is a place in America for Muslim Americans like him. It's quite a moment. And then, of course, the two arguments, Donald Trump saying, this is it, folks. This is your one opportunity for historic change. On the other side, you've got Hillary Clinton saying, this is it, folks. This is your one opportunity to essentially say no to a candidate who is just going to bring calamity right across the board, more or less, in her view. So quite a moment here in New Hampshire. And of course, that's the other thing, Megna. So much focus on New Hampshire, which is quite unusual at this late date. And that's because this remains a very competitive state. And Donald Trump sees it as a key to his path to success. And I think the Clinton campaign sees it as a key opportunity to block Donald Trump from getting there.
Wow. So Anthony Brooks jumping back and forth between parallel universes for us. But just to tell us for a second here, because Anthony, at a Florida rally today, Donald Trump claimed to be leading in states, battleground states like Ohio, North Carolina, and New Hampshire. Now, you talked about the UNH polling a couple of minutes ago. Why is Trump making this claim still on New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm gonna cop out and sort of say what politicians always say: that the only poll that really matters is the vote tomorrow. And I think we, in this election cycle in particular, it seems like we've all become obsessed with the polls. And obviously, the candidates, to get their voters out and to charge them up, they want to tell them we're ahead. And you can look at any number of polls that definitely show the race has tightened in the last two or three weeks. Donald Trump is doing well in some of the big battleground states like Ohio, for example. Florida is very, very close. North Carolina as well. But if you're on the Clinton campaign, you can look at a number of polls that make it look pretty good for her as well. And I think there is a consensus that if you're just looking at polling, Clinton has a big advantage right now and Donald Trump has the steep hill to climb. But of course, the only poll that matters, Megna, is the one that many Americans are going to be participating in tomorrow.
That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. He's at the rally at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, where President Obama will be speaking momentarily. Anthony, it's been such a long election, but I have to say, I'm going to miss these check-ins with you. Thanks so much.
Well, we'll have to find something else to talk about, Megna. Look forward to it.
Thanks again. Well, maybe we'll be talking about the aftermath of the four ballot questions here in Massachusetts, because that is where the attention has been in this state, and it's been a very expensive fight. Committees for and against each question are required to file their final campaign finance reports with the state tonight at midnight. But so-called late contribution reports have been trickling in over the past few days. Radio Boston senior associate producer Kathleen McNerney has been following the ballot question money this entire political season. And Kathleen, let's start with ballot question 2. That, of course, is the question to lift the cap on charter schools. It's getting national news attention, and lots of out-of-state money, making it the single most expensively fought ballot question in Massachusetts history. So how much has been raised by both camps so far?
So far, $38 million has been raised just on this question alone. That eclipses the 2014 total for all the ballot questions. In 2014, it was $30 million.
Again, and that was for all the ballot questions in 2014.
And just this one.
And so just this one, we have $38 million raised so far. Okay, so let's start with the no side then. How much have they raised and who's the money been coming from?
So the no side, it's almost $15 million. And the vast majority, 99%, comes from teachers' unions. The Massachusetts Teachers Association has chipped in the most, about half of that amount.
Half of that amount. Okay, so what, 99% or more overall of all the no money's coming from a bunch, several teachers' unions?
Yep.
Okay. Is it the same story on the yes side, a small group of large donors? How much have they raised?
That's this story. So on the yes side, it's $24 million total. $20 million of that, the largest portion, is from a group called Families for Excellent Schools. They're based in New York, an advocacy group. We've tried reaching out to them many times and sort of get the runaround on the phone system. They were founded by big Wall Street players, such as Paul Applebaum, who's a principal at Rock Ventures. He also created Seamless, the online delivery system. So if you look at and break down the numbers, a lot of this money is coming from out of state and from people who have made their wealth in areas other than education and want to have their say on this issue.
Hmm. And Families for Excellent Schools, as you and I have been reporting for a couple months now, as a not-for-profit, is not required to disclose who its donors are.
Right. So that's the big question. I mean, the vast majority of this money that's coming in, we don't really know who they are or what stake or interest they might have in our education system here in Massachusetts.
Hmm. So, but on either side, it's two small groups raising vast sums of money. And I crunched the numbers on the late contributions that have come in about the past 10 days just for ballot question two. And I calculated some over a little over $5 million pulled in a 10-day period.
Right. It's staggering.
Wow. Well, Kathleen, stand by here for just a second because I want to move over to ballot question one. That's the question of whether or not to add another slot parlor in Massachusetts. And let's bring back Stephanie Ebert. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe. She's been reporting on this for some time. Stephanie, it's great to talk with you again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Okay. So tell us, what do we know about the story of who's financing ballot question one?
Well, big surprise last week. The campaign for the slots initiative submitted some new filings to the State Office of Campaign and Political Finance that acknowledged what some of us had long suspected, was that this group was being funded by casino developers who have done work elsewhere in the United States and around the world. So it's a group called Bridge Capital that's leading it, as well as some other affiliates. And they have raised $3.2 million on this effort as of last week.
And what do we know about other projects they've financed before?
So this group called Bridge Capital is two guys named John Baldwin and Sean Scott. Sean Scott is pretty well known in the United States for having launched very similar ballot initiatives. They have tried in New York, in Washington, D.C., Louisiana. They had numerous attempts at it in Guam, and they had a casino that was operational in the country of Laos until last year when they got in a big dispute with the government and the casino was seized.
Wow. The fact that this Massachusetts referendum is so bizarrely global in nature still stops me in my tracks. But,
yeah.
But Stephanie, have you been able to talk to the elusive Eugene McCain, the man whose land the slot parlor may go on, you know, if the question is passed? I mean, have you talked to him since these new filings
came through? Not since these new filings came out. He sent an email and he said he would answer questions, but he has not.
Yeah.
But fascinating, yes, to be researching. The Bridge Capital, in fact, is based in the Northern Mariana Islands. So my research has led me as far as Guam for this.
Well, while I've got you, let me ask you, though, on the other side of ballot question one in opposition, has there been any spending from other big casino names?
Yes, a little bit. Last week, there was a filing also made by Wynn. Wynn Resorts had started an opposition campaign and announced last week they'd put $30,000 into it. I'm expecting that might still go up in the final days, but that's what they had reported as of last week. And there's also a residents group that had been opposing this effort that just has a smattering of money. Now, it was interesting when Wynn got involved previously, there was a local referendum on this issue in Revere on October 18th. And at that point, Wynn was below the radar funding an opposition campaign along with the residents in Revere who were fighting against this proposal. They were successful in knocking it down in Revere, but if it would pass statewide, it would come back before them.
Wow, so laying the groundwork there for that possibility.
Right.
Well, Stephanie Ebert is reporter for the Boston Globe. She brought us up to speed on spending and money raising around ballot question one. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's turn back to Radio Boston Senior Associate Producer Kathleen McNerney, who's here with me in the studio. Got a couple more ballot questions to go over here, Kathleen. What about question three? That's the one about banning the sale in Massachusetts of meat or eggs from animals that are confined. What's the spending there?
Yeah, so it's a similar story on the yes side. Probably no surprise here. It's advocacy groups for animals. So you have the Humane Society giving 74% of the $2.5 million that they've raised so far, ASPCA and the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals have also donated large sums.
So that's the yes side. And in opposition, what kind of money have they raised?
I mean, compared to the $2.5 million on the yes side, it's a small number, about $300,000 raised. A large portion of that comes from Forrest Lucas, president of Lucas Oil. Who knew? $200,000.
And we don't know why.
We haven't reached out to him directly, so it's unclear why, if this is something that he just feels passionately about. The next largest is the National Pork Producers Council, which makes a bit more sense.
Yeah.
when you look at the interest at stake there.
How much have they put in?
They've put in about $110,000.
Just $110,000. Okay. Well, so let's finish off here with ballot question four. And that, of course, is the other really big ballot question that voters are going to grapple with. And that's the one about whether to legalize recreational marijuana. So first of all, in total, how much has been raised on this ballot question?
A little over $8 million total.
$8 million. Okay.
Yeah, it's a big one. And the leader on that is the yes side, about $5.5 million raised in support of question four. 80% of that comes from a super PAC called New Approach PAC, which is based in Washington, D.C., and their sole focus is on loosening marijuana laws in the United States.
Huh. And so then on the no side, that the little, what, $2.5 million or so?
$3 million.
$3 million. Yeah. Okay. And who's putting most of the money there?
So the largest donor is Sheldon Adelson, the Vegas casino mogul. He's donated $1 million of his own money. The second
In opposition to marijuana legalization.
Yeah. The other biggest donor, Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Boston, really opposed to it, and they've put in $850,000 of their own money or their parishioners' money into this.
So, Kathleen, you and I have been obsessing over campaign finance.
So many spreadsheets.
For many weeks and many months here, and we had this discussion a lot during our editorial meeting. I feel like it's a remarkable thing that most of these ballot questions here in Massachusetts, which are ostensibly, focused on local issues, are drawing such vast sums of money from well outside of the state.
Yeah, I mean, you think of this as a grassroots democratic process. There's this whole signature gathering and groundswell of support, rallies, that sort of thing. But when you break down who's financing it, even when these are very personal questions, there are some key interest groups that are pouring money to try to influence the election to go the way that they see fit. And I don't know whether it's ideological or there's some financial stake. I think it's different for each donor, but I think it's important to keep in mind as you head to the polls and vote.
Yeah, because there are moneyed interests on either side who have aims and goals in mind, which may or may not align with the democratic ideal that is a voter referendum.
Exactly.
Well, Kathleen McNerney is senior associate producer here at Radio Boston. She has been our numbers and money girl for the past many months. Kathleen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Do you remember this trending Facebook story from back in August? It was about Megyn Kelly getting fired from Fox News. Well, it might have been trending, but it was news to Kelly herself.
Also tonight, a phony article about yours truly manages to climb its way to the top of Facebook's trending feature. Fired! What? So can I sue my friends at Facebook?
Well, that fake news story was just one of many to make it to Facebook's trending topics list. It was easy to debunk that one, but what about the thousands of others? Well, joining us now with more is Filippo Menser, professor of computer science and the director of the Center for Complex Networks and Systems Research at the Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Hello, Magna.
Hi. Well, first of all, tell us, how big of a problem is fake news on social media networks?
Well, part of the problem is that we don't know how big it is. We know that there is a huge amount of misinformation that is flowing around in social media, but we are just beginning research efforts to try and quantify the effect. There is, in fact, a study that came out just today from some colleagues at the University of Southern California who used the tool that we developed to detect social bots on Twitter. And by doing a large-scale analysis of tweets about the elections, they found that a very large percentage, about 20% of all tweets about the election, seems to be generated by bots.
Huh.
So that's quite surprising, and we don't really know the effect of that avalanche of misinformation.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's interesting news about Twitter. But take us back to Facebook here for just a second, because in terms of trending topics, is there any human editorial oversight to that? There is a little bit, isn't there?
Well, there used to be.
Yeah.
In fact, that, you know, those trending topics were vetted by editors, and then there was some controversy and some accusations that Facebook's editors were possibly biased. As far as I know, those allegations were not really confirmed. So we don't know if that was also misinformation. It was based on one account. But the backlash towards Facebook was huge. And as a result, they decided to make the algorithm that completely automated. And then after that happened, we've seen some examples of fake news that made it into the trending feed.
Right. Now, there's also the opportunity that people might have when they're looking at a particular story and popping up next to it are stories you also might like, which could lead to some of these fake news sites, right?
Yes, it's possible. My understanding is that Facebook is trying really hard to try and show a breadth of different sources of information. And sometimes the mechanism that you described is also very useful, because if you're looking at a fake news, sometimes what you see underneath is a link to a fact-check site that tells you that, in fact, that piece of news maybe is not true. So it could help and it could also hinder. But in general, the things that you see on your feed are highly affected by the mechanisms by which social media decide what you may want to see and what you are most likely to engage with.
Okay, so
So the things that you might be excited about are not necessarily the ones that are most accurate.
I think that is a true statement, absolutely, especially in this election cycle. But let me ask you, I mean, is there a way for an algorithm to tell the difference between real and fake news?
Not at this stage. It would be nice to get to that, maybe in several years. This is still in the realm of, in the area of artificial intelligence that we are very far from. Our group is doing a lot of research on trying to answer different bits of this question, trying to see whether you can fact check some very, very simple statements by computational methods. But we are really at the very beginning. Right now, only a human, and sometimes even for humans, it is difficult to discern whether a piece of news is true or not. There is so much background information that is required. There is contextual information. That's why, you know, journalists, professionals like you, spend a lot of resources doing fact checks. And the problem is that, you know, you can't keep up because there is so much misinformation out there. So the traditional method of fact-checking, which is guided by humans, you know, expert journalists doing their work, doesn't scale with the volume of misinformation.
Well, exactly, because the volume is very, very large. I mean, there was a story, for example, claiming that Hillary Clinton would be indicted in 2017. Just that one story, but it was shared and commented on more than 140,000 times on Facebook, which, of course, engagement then is what further drives the proliferation of these stories. I mean, I don't see how any company could hire enough people to keep up with that kind of volume.
Yeah, it is really impossible. And the nature of social media is that, you know, the business model is for them to get people engaged so that they will click on ads. And also, there is now a cottage industry of websites that do nothing other than fabricating fake news just so that people can click and they can make some money out of our ads. And it's very cheap to fabricate fake stories, especially ones that will engage either through outraging, making people outrageous depending on their political beliefs. And you and I are likely victims. If we see something that seems to match what we believe or what we feel, we're more likely to believe it and to click on it. And as a result, then other people, our friends, see it, and they may think that we have vetted it and that we've looked into it. And so it's very easy through the mechanisms of social media to propagate this fake news. They spread very, very fast inside our filter bubbles or echo chambers among those that are that are more likely to believe them. And it happens on all sides of the political spectrum. So what to do about it is a very tough question.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, I mean, let's also acknowledge that these social media companies make their money through those clicks. They want user engagement. And if a lot of these fake news sites are getting a lot of engagement because of our polarized politics, because of the fact that people, as you said earlier, like we are in our own little information bubbles, are amplifying the power and reach of these fake news sites, doesn't that present a conflict of interest for companies like Facebook and Twitter? On the one hand, they say, yeah, they want to control the fake news, but on the other hand, they're making a lot of money from the engagement that these sites produce.
Let me start by saying that I have some great colleagues who work at Facebook and Twitter, and they do great work, and they work really hard to try and address these problems. So it's not the case that people at these companies don't care. That being said, clearly, it is tough, and their goal is, as you said, engagement. And actually, it's even our goal. We wouldn't use a platform if it's not fun and if it doesn't show us things that we're interested. And sometimes that's innocuous, maybe cat pictures from our sister, but other times it could be dangerous if it's misinformation. And the problem, like you said, is that there is a misalignment between, you know, the incentives towards getting people engaged and the incentives to provide accurate information. I mean, traditional media, which are beleaguered all the time, but they had a very strong editorial role. Their role, their business model, was to provide accurate and fact-checked information. And now, yes, it's nice that anybody can be a producer of information, but the flip side of that is that, there is these incentives to produce all sorts of junk.
Well,
so
we have...
Yeah.
I just... Forgive me for interrupting, but we've got just less than a minute to go, and I wanted to end with this idea that, according to the Pew Centers, more than 40% of American adults say they get at least some of their news from Facebook. Obviously, Facebook has 1.7 billion users around the world. I mean, what can social media users do to protect themselves from the spread of this fake news?
That's a very good question. I think the first step is for people to be aware that they can be victim of manipulation. With new technology, we often don't know at the beginning what possible dangers may come from it. And if people are aware that they can be cheated, just like they can, you shouldn't accept candy from a stranger. We teach that to our children. But we don't know how to teach about checking sources, checking accuracy. Sometimes it's easy. All it takes is a search on a search engine. Other times it's hard. You have to look around. And generally, you just have to be skeptic. Sometimes a piece of news seems like it should be true, and you're so sure that it's true, and you share it without even checking it, and in fact, it's not. So
well,
not only you become the victim, but you also become the perpetrator.
Exactly. So maintaining a healthy skepticism, always important for a functioning democracy. Filippo Mentzer is professor of computer science and the director of the Center for Complex Networks and Systems Research at the Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Over the past several months, we've spoken with many people on both sides of ballot question two. That's the question to lift the cap on charter schools. We've talked with some major donors on either side of the spectacularly expensive campaigns. We've talked with local officials and education policy experts. Well, today, we're going to hear from two parents. They have different views on question two, and let me make something clear. We are not trying to, and we are not interested in pitting parents against each other. That has been happening in this campaign, and I think it's a shame. Instead, we're simply going to hear what two parents want for their children's education. We're going to hear about their experiences and their stories. They are both mothers, and they both live in Boston. First, Shalina Semexent of Dorchester.
I have three beautiful children. Janae is 10 years old. She loves dancing and singing. Joshua loves video games. He's 7 years old. And Gianna, my five-year-old, she loves driving her older brother and sister crazy.
Well, Shalina's oldest daughter goes to the Dennis C. Haley Pilot School in Roslindale. That's a district school where the state has classified as a level three school, which means it's amongst the lowest 20% of similar schools. Shalina's two other children attend Kipp Academy Boston Charter School, which the state ranks as level one. She says Joshua and Gianna have a very different experience at school than her oldest daughter.
I see the progress in both Gianna and Joshua. For example, he just learned about rocket ships and space, and he comes home and he's able to explain about the planets. He's just in the second grade, and Gianna's reading right now, and she's only five. And then Janae comes home, and it's nothing. She hasn't been able to share any growth, anything she's learned in school. She's just coming home telling me everything that I've taught her this past summer.
Why do you think that is?
Janae is just one of many children out there who needs extra help in school, and I believe right now she's not getting the help. What breaks my heart is to know that her brother's catching up to her. It upsets her, it frustrates her that he can do her homework, and they're two grades apart from each other. I see how well my son articulates. My daughter, she's smart and she's brilliant, but academically, she's behind.
And what do you think is preventing her from getting the additional help or assistance that she needs at the pilot school?
Not enough time. My daughter has had challenges for many years. And one of the things that all her teachers have said to me is they don't have the time to work with her. Mm-hmm. So what I had to do was to fight for her to get an IEP. This past spring, she got an IEP. In the last 2 months, it's been at a standstill because there's been no progress and no growth with the IEP. So we're right back to where we've been. More crying for me, more crying for her, because I'm trying to figure out what I need to do as a mother to help her, and crying for her because she's in school for 7 hours and then she has to come home and sit another 3 hours and do more studying.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me like you very strongly want all your children to be in charter schools. And so therefore, I'm going to guess that you support question two.
Yes, I do support question two.
Yeah. And what kind of conversations have you had, with other parents, both at your two younger kids' school?
Yes.
and also at your elder daughter's school as well about this issue?
See, all parents want quality education for their kids. At the charter schools, parents are thankful that their kids are getting that opportunity. At the Boston Public School, we don't have a voice. Our voice is not being heard, that our children are failing. And all we can do is go home and try to reteach our children what they're supposed to be doing in school for those hours.
What's your response to folks who say that if question two were to be passed, that since the money follows the student, more money would be removed from the district schools and put into charter schools, which would then make it even harder in the district schools to, try to get the kind of services that you're talking about that your elder daughter already doesn't get, that it would make it even harder for them to do that for the students who remain in the district?
We want our kids in the inner city to receive quality education. We want them to grow up and to be successful. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. So it truly breaks my heart that not lifting the cap I don't know how to say this, but a no on two would mean that there'll be more kids out there not getting quality education. A yes on two would mean more children would get that opportunity instead of staying in failing schools that are not giving them that quality of education.
Well, so, I mean, I completely hear you in terms of the passion and the commitment that you have for getting all your kids what they need. And obviously we know that there are many thousands of parents who feel the same, very same way. But I'm just wondering, what's your message for the parents of the, you know, the 90% of kids who do remain in district schools? What's your message for them?
Right now, I am with those parents and I'm fighting. My daughter is just like everyone else. She's still in traditional public school. So on that end, I'm saying we want change. Understand that many of our kids learn differently. All kids don't learn the same way. And if change doesn't take place now, then what else do we have?
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you're also a substitute teacher?
Yes, I am.
In the Boston Public Schools?
Yes.
So tell me about that.
It's a beautiful experience because I get to teach other kids. But it's heartbreaking when you see kids in the classroom who are dealing with challenges. It's heartbreaking when you see children in a classroom who are just like my daughter, who does not get it. And once that class time is up, I don't have any more time to go back and help them learn anything more than I can.
Is there anything about question two that you think would help the teachers who in the district schools get more time to spend with the students who need it?
I would love for people to walk into charter schools and just go observe. Take a day, go sit down in the classroom and observe how the teachers work with the students. See how you have a classroom of about 25 students in a charter school and there's two teachers in the classroom, and observe how she teaches her lessons and she's redirecting the kids. And after the lesson is done, she doesn't just stop. There's time to find out if the kids have learned what she's taught, and there's time within that time to go back and help the students who missed it the first time. Like, it's beautiful to watch the extra time they have in the classroom to go back and work with those students individually.
Mm-hmm. Overall, this question it seems to be really dividing people.
It is.
I mean, do you have conversations about question two with friends and neighbors? I mean, what are people around you saying?
I've had a lot of conversations. I try to remind people this is not a charter versus public school issue. It's really not. It's about our children. When you see something working, charter schools are working for many children out there, and you see the child is excelling and progressing, it's beautiful. As a mom, you have a sense of ease to know that your child is getting what they need. You have a sense of comfort. You don't have to wake up like, oh my goodness, she's missing it. She's missing that opportunity. And there's children that are in traditional public school and they're being left behind. My daughter is with them being left behind. This might be another wasted year of her not getting caught up to where she needs to be. I mean, moms tell me, they share my story. But I say to them, why aren't you standing with me? You share my story, but why aren't you standing with me? Because nobody want to shake up anything. Nobody want to cause any problems. But there's people without a voice. I call them the voiceless people because they don't want to speak up. It just breaks my heart. One of the things that I go around and I tell other parents, go into the school, and I'm talking about in BPS, ask the teacher where your child is on reading and math level. Ask them. Last year, my son was in the first grade and my daughter was in the third grade. My son comes home and he's reading on the same grade level as my daughter. I had to question either he's advanced or she's behind. I went to her school first to find out, hey, can you let me know where my daughter is placed and what's going on with her? It took them 3 months to actually tell me where she was. They really didn't want to tell me how far behind she was. She started in the third grade and she's on a beginning second grade level. That scared me to know that, wait a minute, she's behind? My daughter has been here for 4 years. I've left her academics in the hands of BPS, and they never told me that she was so far behind. I knew she had challenges, but I didn't know to what extent her challenges were because they didn't inform me, you know? And I'm finding parents in the last couple of weeks that are coming back to me and saying, it's not good. It's not good. We were never told.
Well, and finally, we've been asking this question of everyone that we've talked to about question two. Are you on the staff of the Yes on Two campaign? Are you getting paid by Yes on Two in any way?
No, I am not. I am just a mom that cries daily because her daughter is not getting the education she will need. I'm just a mom that's passionate about this right now. So, no, I am not getting paid.
Well, Shalina Samexent, thank you so very much for sharing your thoughts and sharing your story. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we asked Boston Public Schools to comment on Shalina's assertion that she had to fight to get her daughter an IEP, or Individualized Education Program. BPS said it cannot comment publicly on confidential student information. They said in a statement that the Haley Pilot School uses, quote, an inclusion model of learning and, quote, works extensively with families to ensure the best possible outcome for all students. Well, let's hear now from a parent with a different view on question two. Keisha Lewis is a paraprofessional in the Boston Public Schools. She works with students on the autism spectrum, and she's also the parent of children who attend district schools.
Well, I have three children, 12, 5, and 11 months, two boys and a girl. Two of my boys go to Boston Public School, and my baby obviously is at home. They're great.
Her sons attend Beethoven Elementary School in Roslindale and the William H. Orenberger School in West Roxbury, a level 2 school. Lewis told us that not all Boston schools are in the top tier, but she believes local accountability and parental support are essential to fixing those schools, and she sees evidence of how that can work at her son's own schools right now.
I think the best thing about the schools they're in right now is the parent participation. They really try to stick together and make sure they do the best they can by the students. The parents are really, really active in those schools. However, there are lots of schools in Boston, and they're not all as active. Those same schools in that same neighborhood also got some cuts this past year. So as much as the parents are trying, you know, they're kind of swimming against the current, so to speak.
And how have you seen your sons grow in the years that they've been in the schools?
My oldest son, you know, he ended up with some really great teachers. He's a little shy. They brought him out of his shell. His school has a music program. They have all the sports at his school, K through 8.
Have you spoken with parents who have sent their kids or have chosen a charter school instead of their district school?
I know a couple of people who had some really good experiences. However, I know more people who've had negative experiences. Some of the kids had IEPs, and then a couple of them had some other social-emotional situations, and the schools kind of said that this is not a good fit, you're not going to make it here.
They were told that?
The school told the student / parent that, you know, this is not a good fit for her. We're going to send her back to public school. You know, you should try there. And so it's funny how they'll say that the public school doesn't have certain things, but when they can't handle the student, that's where they send them back to.
Now, let me ask you, you're also a teacher in the Boston
Public
Schools?
I'm a teacher's assistant.
You're a teacher's assistant.
I teach in the summer, but my regular position is a teacher's assistant, which is called a paraprofessional. I work with children diagnosed with autism.
Okay, so tell me what that's like.
Oh, well, I love my job. It's fantastic, actually. I'm really close with all of my students. I've worked with families to help with behaviors outside of work on my own time. So I really get involved and roll my sleeves up, but I absolutely love what I do. And that's another reason why I'm well aware of who the charter, some certain charter schools can take and can't take. They won't take some of my students. But, you know, in my school, we have, 32 students? Huh. Diagnosed with autism, and we have other students diagnosed with other disabilities. And we've done everything we can to keep the resources going, to make sure that we provide the best educational experience for them, not just for their academics, but also socially, which is equally important.
Do you have any concerns about if question two passes, is it possible that it would have an impact on the work that you do?
Absolutely. You know, resources are taken away. So first they'll start with, you know, music or theater, a language, an art program. And in order for students to excel, they have to be well-rounded. You need your academics, but you also need these extracurricular activities. You need these electives. You know, music is really important. The arts is really important. And in order for students to be able to compete with, you know, maybe children at an elite private school, or they're going to have the resources and have to have the exposure to all those resources. And every time they take money away, we're losing them. The school I work at lost several teachers last year. And it really put a strain on how they teach. They had to change the schedule of the whole school. Eventually, it's going to hurt the students.
Yeah. Are any of the students that you work with directly, had any of them been in a charter school?
Oh, no. The students that I work with would probably not be a fit there.
Are they high needs students?
Yes.
Okay.
And we have a program set up for them throughout the city, and different schools within our district are set up for them. So it's very rare that they would be able to go to a different school unless it was a private school.
I see. Okay. Now, what do you say to folks who might be hearing this and saying, well, I'm one of those parents whose school that my kid was placed in Boston isn't one like the ones that your sons
right.
are in, and it's not exactly what I need, and I'd rather send my child to a charter school.
The thing with question two, which is separate from you choosing a charter school for your child, is all the children left behind. So I think what's going on here is it's kind of they're trying to put parents against parents. Like, okay, this is public school parents against charter school parents. Absolutely not. That's not what this is about. The people who are manipulating the situation are behind the scenes. It's not the parents. It's not the teachers. I personally believe for my own kids, I want to keep them in public school because we have to make public school accountable. If something's not working, we don't just throw it away and ditch that idea and go somewhere else. No, we make it work here. Public education is everyone's right. Everyone's entitled to public education. Well, you know what? If that's the case, let's make sure that we get the job done in the public sector where we're supposed to do it.
So I hear you saying that you believe the best thing for you and your children is to stay in the district school system and be part of
the solution.
The solution.
Absolutely. You know, I think that's why some schools are thriving, because the parents all feel that same way. And they're like, you know what? We have to hold you accountable. Let's make sure this school stays great. You know, I'm not saying it's easy or a quick fix, but we have a great school district here. We have the first school district in the country. We have great educators. And I think we need to remember, you know, the history that the city has come from. It's a great place to learn. You know, you look at inner cities all over the country, and in comparison, we're actually doing pretty well. But I think people should be more a part of the solution and not just abandon what actually is their right. But here in the public school system, we have to answer to the parent, which I think we should. Parents are who we have to answer to. They're the public. And I have no problem with private schools. Private schools are great. However, private schools are not getting money from the public, which is the point.
Some folks would say, though, that charter schools do have accountability. It may not be to the local district, but they have accountability to the state, because the state reviews their charters every 5 years.
Right. And, you know, they probably would say that. But, I mean, that's just their way of getting by. I just don't think that that's honest, because they should be accountable to the public in the neighborhoods, actually. You can go to your neighborhood school and the playgrounds, you can, you know, your kids can play at the playground on a Saturday. It's a Boston public school. That's a city park. You can play there. You can use the facilities. You can ask to use facilities for different reasons. But you can't do that when it's taken away and used privately. It's our school. There are buildings. And I think we just need to remember that and make our schools continue to make them great. I mean, we have some great schools. And I think people just kind of get caught up in the one bad school over here or the one bad situation over here. But we have to think about the big picture.
I'm so grateful that you've come in. And actually, I'm grateful to every parent who's spoken to us, because I don't ever want to come across as being a person who's pitting parent against parent. Because I
right.
think you've pointed that out. That's not how we should be talking about this. So I just want to make it clear that.
But it has gone, you know, even myself, when I'm talking to people, it goes that way sometimes by accident. You know, it's not on purpose. But when people feel passionate about something,
yeah,
it can get lost yeah. in translation, I guess.
Well, let me ask you, why do you think question two is so important?
It's important because education, it's more important than just about anything. I would just say that voting no on question two keeps it with us. We know what we need to fix. We know what's working, and we need to keep that. But if we have someone take it away from us, then our hands are tied. We'll have no rights. We'll have no voice. The public won't have a say. And for the city who has the first public school in America, you know, I think that's a pretty big deal. I mean, this is historic.
Well, you know, last question, and this is something that because of all the money that's been pouring in about question two, I got to ask everybody, have you received any money from the No on Two campaign? Are you being paid by them?
No. You know, what I think about the most as far as question two is I think about my children and my grandchildren. That's why it's so important to me. I mean, obviously, my kids are already in school. It won't be an immediate effect on my children. But think about what's going to happen down the line. And so I think about, you know, my grandchildren and how will they have the same opportunities? Will they be able to get the same education that I'm giving to my kids now? Or would they have to pay for it? Will they have to fight for it? You know, I'm worried about that. I'm worried about what's going to happen for our future and how education may be harder to obtain because there are going to be different set of rules for different people.
Well, Keisha Lewis is both a Boston Public School parent and a paraprofessional in the Boston Public Schools. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And I'll add that Keisha is also a member of the Boston Teachers Union. Again, we heard a differing view on question two from Shalina Semexent of Dorchester earlier in this segment. I want to thank them both for sharing their stories. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.